Welcome to Cultural Fugazi, an optimistic take on the culture of the end times. I am your host, Justice, and I am joined always by my co-host, Chris.
Hello.
Today, we're going to do stuff a little bit different. We read a book.
Woo!
Normally, we watch movies or various other things. But one of the things that we did is you read this book. You were like, Justice, I think this is worthwhile for us to talk about on the podcast. And I said, Chris, it's also your podcast. You could just do it. You don't have to ask me for permission. But I read it too. So we're going to talk about it together today. Chris, you want to talk about kind of like where you found this and how we got here?
Yeah, absolutely. So as it turns out, I actually found this because you recommended it years ago.
I have no idea that I have done this.
Yeah, this is a surprise to you. New knowledge. So a couple years ago, and again, I think you probably saw it on Twitter or something along those lines. You saw, hey, this philosopher has written a book about identity politics. Like, hey, Chris, you like philosophy and you have opinions about identity politics. This seems like maybe a book you would be interested in.
That sounds a lot like me. I just don't remember doing it. Like, oh, yeah, no, this Chris should read this. Yeah, I think he would like this a lot.
Yes.
So,
well, it turns out, yes. Check. And I ended up reading it recently in part because I listened to this other podcast that exclusively talks about terrible books called If Books Could Kill. And they recently did an episode on Yascha Mounk's Identity Politics, The Identity Trap. I don't know that I would necessarily say run out and grab that book. There's a reason that it was on a podcast called If Books Could Kill. But they do mention this book as part of that conversation because there are some overlapping themes. And I heard that and went, you know what? I should read that book because Justice mentioned it years ago and maybe now's a good time.
And probably they mentioned this as like one of the alternatives that are not bad.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be my assumption. And the book we're talking about today is, I'm trying to make sure I have the full title, unless you got it in front of you right now.
I do. It is Elite Capture, How the Powerful Took Over Identity Politics and Everything Else.
All right. And it is by Ulufeme O. Taiwo.
Yes.
Taiwo. So, Taiwo is on Blue Sky. I saw a reshare of something from him recently, and I was like, oh, hey, we just read this book, and here he is on Blue Sky. So we'll dive into that a little bit. But Chris, you got this book from the Cleveland Public Library.
I did. Justice, how did you know?
Chris recommends me this book, and I go, okay, well, I'm going to do what I always do, which is listen to it and try to see if there's an audiobook version. Now, this is let's call it a smaller publication, and I think there's less demand for a philosophy book about specific culture takes.
Mm-hmm.
So the library had one audiobook copy.
Yes.
And I had to put a hold on it because someone else was reading this this 2021 book about identity, politics, and culture. So I messaged Chris and I said, I have a hold on this. Can you give the book back to the library? And then I got the notification that the book was available for me to listen to.
Which is not only a fun story, but a good reminder, libraries are great.
Yeah,
you should use your library.
Yeah, use your library. Support your library. If they have like fun merch that helps the library, buy fun library shit.
Absolutely. I think this year, one of my goals is to get more involved with doing library stuff. So I will probably mention more of that if and when it comes up. But get Libby. It's a great app. I believe that is the app that we both use to listen to audiobooks, and you can get ebooks through it. I spend a lot of money on books already.
Yeah, we talked about this whenever we did the episode of The Boy and the Heron, which is if we could be locked into towers, or if blocking ourselves into towers and reading too many books made mad wizards, that we'd be fucked.
Yeah, it's true.
So, Libby is essential to my... Chris, you read...
Last year was just 100... No, I'm sorry, 105.
105 books.
Yes.
And that would be impossible without the use of the public library, because we would be broke.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So we're going to get into it a little bit. Kind of before we get started, I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of our goals for the year. Hey, we talked a little bit about last year. This is our first episode of 2024. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody.
By the time you hear this, you'll be tired. No one will be saying that by now. But hey, it's still the first time we're talking to you, so Happy New Year. Unless you were here for the party, and then in which case we saw you. the thing that kind of going into this year, hey, we talked about it in the episodes we did for December. We're trying to get back into like making this a regular thing. Chris came down on a Saturday. I'm so proud of him. Yeah, he texted me at a reasonable time, not at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I texted him at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a nice reverse take. And we're going to try to make sure that we do some fun stuff. So we're going to be doing, this is not the only episode about a book we are going to do. I promise you that. So we'll be doing more book stuff. There's some TV stuff now that things are getting weird in the streaming front that I want to make sure that maybe some stuff we talk about before it probably disappears or some such. And then there's some great movies that I think, are coming out already in January with, American Fiction looks great.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I have yet to see The Iron Claw, which wrestling is important to me. So I will be watching that for sure. And that might be something worthwhile to talk about. I think there's enough there that's interesting, especially about small town politics and how some of these things work. And so I think there's a lot there, or potentially some if and when I watch it. There's some bigger movies coming out this year, but I don't think any of us really know what they are because of the repercussions of the writer strike and the actor strike. So there's some gaps, I think, in what our calendars are for movie releases, or at least in mine.
Oh yeah. And it looks like this is a very heavy sequel release year in a way that I personally am not super excited about.
Every year a heavy sequel release year now?
I mean, yeah, but this one seems particular, and it's probably particularly bad because of the writer strike. I'm sure that a lot of that has to do with original movies being, you know, pushed back on the back burner more quickly, having these sequels kind of ready to go and just like timing them out. So I'm sure that is part of it, but this seems like a particularly, you know what? It's probably going to be a great time for us to have a discussion about nostalgia.
Oh yeah. We'll probably do nostalgia. We'll probably do, we have not done a Jaws episode yet.
That's true, we have
and, not. And the new Stern pinball game that's coming out is Jaws themed. So I've been thinking a lot about Jaws. So there's an opportunity there. All kinds of fun stuff for us to do this year. And books, a lot of books. I'll probably make us do some more books very, very soon. But our next episode, and maybe even the one after, might be books.
I like that. That plan, that's a good plan.
Yeah. So that's kind of our plan for the year. Hopefully your plan for the year is way more organized. You know, maybe do something nice for yourself. Take care of yourself this year. It's going to be a hard one. It's an election year.
Whew.
And, you know, there's all kinds of things in the news, which is why we're here to be optimistic about the other stuff. So let's get into Elite Capture.
Yeah, I think, you know, mentioning the news, and I don't want to get too like heavy into details that are probably really time frame specific and not as applicable to like generalized themes, but there's a lot going on in the news now, and I expect that this will be true certainly for the rest of this year about identity, or that has to do with sort of weaponizing identity. And I think part of what I have found frustrating over the last few years is that it doesn't really feel like there is an affirmative stance on the left concerning identity and the way that we should talk about it, the way that we should think about it, how useful it is, and what we may or maybe do or don't need to change about it, and how we approach it. And so one of the things that really appealed to me about this book is that feels like it's Taiwo's project here, or at least part of creating the foundation for exactly that kind of thing. So I think this is a good entry point into starting that conversation. And I anticipate that it's going to be a theme that we'll revisit throughout the year as we talk about more stuff. But like, just know that we are aware that, you know, like things that are happening with higher education, because suddenly everybody cares about Harvard, which don't care about Harvard. No one should care about
Harvard. I promise you have 1,000 more things to care about that are more important than Harvard.
Absolutely. I may or may not have a family member who attended the institution to get a law degree. They got a lovely education, but they did mention, hey, this place is not as important as it thinks it is.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, what we'll get into, I think, with some of that is specifically the term elite capture. Yes. And how some of these institutions can be weaponized for, you know, I guess I'm looking for not just right wing as the overall term, but because it's not just right wing, right? It's middle, it's the central liberals, right? It's that center left can definitely get skewed into some nefarious shit from some of these specific concepts that are in the book.
Yes.
But the reason, and I guess if we had to have a thesis for today, the reason that, you know, now that Chris and I have both read this, that we thought it would be worthwhile for our podcast specifically, is that there are some great terminologies and words and ideas expressed in this specific book that as we continue to analyze books and movies and other forms of art that are produced as cultural objects and the specific politics and cultural influences thereof, the book in question, Elite Capture, Taiwo does a great job of explaining and adding vocabulary to us and some examples of what this means for us. And I think it's a great lens and some tools that we can take and have in the tool chest as we watch more stuff.
Yeah. And I think very nice to have the ability to point to a work and say, hey, if you want an introduction to these sorts of concepts, here is this great work by Taiwo that deals with this in a very approachable way, instead of being like, oh, well, would you like to read some Fanon?
Yeah, because Chris did that. Yeah, Chris did that to me, and it's still in my drawer next to the bed. I've gotten about halfway through, and then I read Babel, and you're like, well, and I was like, the parts of Babel I liked, and you're like, well, you would like Fanon.
Yeah, it's very important, but maybe not as approachable. Definitely not as approachable as Taiwo is. Yeah. I think Taiwo does a very nice job of making this accessible, which is in and of itself a very good thing.
Yeah. So that's the thesis. So that's kind of what we're going in with today. We're probably going to break it down. The book has about 5 chapters. It's not a very long book. I think it clocks in at about 100 and something pages.
Yeah.
Maybe a little less.
Yeah, the audiobook is like
3.5 hours at 2x speed. Narrated great, by the way.
Yeah.
Really well done. So yeah, if you are a fast audiobook listener or an avid podcast listener, you can crank through this thing in no time, especially if you have a Cleveland Public Library subscription. You mm-hmm. can get that for free. So those are some of your options there on how to consume this thing, and you could go listen to that. We'll not, it's a 3-hour audiobook. We're not going to do probably an hour of podcast on an idea that's already well done and expressed. So we'll kind of get through these things as we go. But we're going to break it down probably based on some of the parts of the book, talk about some of the details at a high level. Like I was saying before, there are really 5 key parts. Those parts kind of, as we get into the idea of elite capture, part 1 is, what is elite capture? So we'll talk about this as a concept. 2, reading the room. We'll talk about kind of what he means by the room and what some of those ideas are. 3, being in the room as a separate thing from reading the room. 4, building a new house. And 5, the point is to change it. And then probably some final thoughts from us on some of those concepts as well. So it's kind of the structure we're going to take. We have not done a book. We usually just talk you through a movie. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a little different for us. So if we get off the training wheels and fall off the track or another bad metaphor, I apologize.
We're all learning new things. It's a new year.
Yeah, try new stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Chris, what is elite capture? Can you get us there?
Well, so let's start off by, I think it is, and I really love what Taiwo does here. What is an elite? And I think this to me is an really, really important definition that may be a little bit different than what you might expect. So, what is an elite? Taiwo describes an elite as somebody who has an outsized amount of power or say in a particular situation, and it does not necessarily mean that. So I think we often assume that elite means, oh, like a Harvard administrator is an elite. It's like, well, actually, there might be some certain circumstances where that particular individual is not an elite based on the power imbalances with the other people that they're dealing with. Let's say they're at a congressional hearing. And
what a very specific example.
Yeah, wild, right? Just pulled that out of thin air. So in that, at that case, particularly if, let's say, said administrator is a black woman and the Congress people involved are, let's say, white men, rich white men, there might be a slight imbalance in the amount of power that is being wielded by each of those individuals.
Especially whenever specific things can happen in play. We talk about this later, right? In America, you know, your direct well-being is under our capitalist society. Your direct well-being, including your ability to access healthcare and your ability to live in, you know, to have a place of shelter and to afford sustenance, all of that is tied to things like your job. And especially in a power dynamic scenario where maybe if you fuck up this congressional hearing, or if someone decides that you did not do good at the congressional hearing, or if you were a black woman in a position of some power in a congressional hearing, that people might do things like take away your ability to afford your home or provide sustenance, and you might lose your job, which he does a great job. We'll get kind of into that a little bit more in some of the later sections. But yeah, the power balances in play, who is in that room, and how they're interacting is a lot of, you know, an elite in one scenario. The president of Harvard sounds like an elite on paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty clear, right? If you were to say the president of an institution, for example, to date this podcast a little bit, Youngstown State is going through a similar thing with their president, where mm-hmm. they're pulling in someone that people disagree with as, or they're talking about having them be president of the institution. Youngstown State is probably a little less important than Harvard. Or is it?
Excellent question.
Or is it? So there's some ideas there of what is it to be an elite in these specific institutions or in these scenarios. It's a great summary. It was actually, as we deal with some of these concepts later, we have to have these shared terms, and that's a good one.
Yeah, and I think one of the things about that term that I really love is that because it's a relational term, that means that I can place myself in situations where I can say, oh, in this situation, I'm functioning as an elite, whereas in this situation, I am very much not functioning as an elite. And I think it's good to be able to recognize that your own capacity for being or not being an elite is separate from just like this like platonic ideal of elitism, where like, well, if you are a Harvard administrator who makes X number of dollars, has staff, that like, then you become elite. It's like, no, it is about those relationships, and it is more relational than it is, you know, defined specifically.
Yeah, the thing that I really took away from that, too, was the social media examples, right? You might be a person of high influence in specific situations where you're not a person of any influence in other situations. Or maybe you shouldn't be. And the ways that some of these algorithms work on things like the site formerly known as Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and these things where people become of an elite status on there, they become influencers, or TikTok too. TikTok also exists. I just, as a 30, mid 30s year old man, TikTok is out there. I've been clean now for nine months, but I'm falling in the Instagram hole. I think Instagram's going to be,
it's the next one on the chopping block.
I got to get rid of that fucking button that allows me to just watch dumb shit. I got to turn that part of my brain off.
The elites have captured you.
Yeah, I've been captured. But this concept of, hey, where are you an elite, and how are these things, and what does that mean to be an elite, and how do they exert their influence, right? They frame conversations. They have the ability to provide power, influence the power structure, or set the power structure before anything else really starts to happen in that space.
Yeah, often have an outsized amount of control over what the terms of the conversation even are. Like, what are we even going to talk about? One of the things that drives me completely nuts is that I am forced to think about Elon Musk as a human being.
All the time.
Absolutely. I would prefer to never have to think about him ever. But the issue is that as an elite, and based on his position owning a social media company, like just having the most money in the world means that he has outsized influence that, unfortunately, I don't get to ignore. So I'm forced to occasionally, at the very least, consider that human being.
Yeah, and that's a bummer.
It is a bummer.
To frame this conversation really quick, if you're a constant listener of the podcast, I guess we should talk about this. This book specifically talks not just about race, but race is a concept that is definitely talked about in the book.
Yes.
If you do not know Chris and I personally, I am white, Chris is black. So if there are things here where I sound more stupid in specific situations, sorry. But it's not just that, but hey, there are concepts of race that we're going to be talking about for some of these things, especially when you talk about, you know, hey, that term elite is contextual.
Yes.
That will, you know, race plays a major factor in that context. So, hey, it turns out if I have not seen this a lot or have not felt this, it's probably because I'm a white man. You know, that's usually a lot of the, well, I can just say things and people will just listen, right? Like, that's normal for me. So that's one of those things that, hey, if I'm, you know, and somewhat blind to some of these concepts, or I'm like, oh, you know, I never really thought of it that way, it'll be pretty obvious why.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, I think that a perfect example. So I'm black, but class wise, you know, I'm not poor. So that means that where my like elite like structurally falls, like there are, again, situations where I am very much, even with some white folks in rooms, I wield more power and influence than they do just based on my class position versus my race position.
Yep.
But there are other rooms where that is not true.
You've been a manager, right?
You've been directly
responsible for people's, well, not directly, but you've been directly responsible for people's wage and whatever.
Yes.
We can have conversations about, hey, the place that I work at, the levers that I can pull to adjust wage can be frustrating for what I think an individual is worth. But also, the direct people who are usually underneath you don't get to have that power. They don't have that, you know, they don't even get to be in the room.
Yep.
And have that conversation. So,
yep. We'll get into that more when we get into the deference stuff that he talks about later, but we'll save that for that section of the book.
Yep.
So back to defining some business. So we now have a better idea of what constitutes an elite. So what does elite capture, and what are they capturing?
Yeah. This is one of those things that it, once it's defined, like became like, oh yeah. And again, you know, we have some very specific examples of things that are happening very much right now, that it was like, oh yeah, that's what the fuck is happening here. you probably have a way better definition lined up than I do.
Well, so I mean, I think
you have for to visualize the room here, Chris has a stack of printed out paper. It is printed out. I have the book on a Kindle in front of me just so I remember specific parts and concepts. No, Chris, he has an iPad. There's a paper. We have bourbon. Like, we're fully equipped. So that's why I was like, if you have the definition directly in front of you, dude. And if you don't, I'll continue to stretch and buy time.
With elites, and one of the specific definitions that is given in the book that kind of I consolidates some of the concepts we've been talking about, this is from political scientist Joe Freeman, who Taiwo references. An elite refers to a small group of people who have power over a larger group of which they are part, usually without direct responsibility to that larger group and often without their knowledge or consent. So now, looking at that and thinking about the ways that we've more informally defined elites, what is elite capture? Well, it's when that small group directs the time, the attention, and the resources of that larger group to things that benefit specifically them or largely them without any sort of respect or consideration to the larger group and how it may impact the larger group. The group has been captured by the elites and directed to do their whims.
Right. It's good that you were able to have the formal definition, because like the whole book is about that, but also, you know, we got to get these terms right up front. It's like I said, you know, the exact thing, right? Social media is a great example because it's literally social media. It is literally people as the primary, you know, likes and views as your primary capital, and how that influences, you know, hey, you should buy this thing and use promo code, whatever. Do you care where that thing comes from? Do you care if that's a good product? Do you care maybe a little bit if your viewers actually, if it's good for your viewers or whoever's, you know, whoever this sponsored ad is for? Probably not. You might not want to recommend shit to them, but probably not. So, hey, they can exert influence that also personally benefits them.
Well, you hear a lot of conversation about things like Twitter mobs and, like, essentially influencers weaponizing their audiences to destroy other influencers or other people who have less influence than they do just because they have the power and they can. And, like, that's very much, is it in the best interest of all of those users to destroy the lives that they're destroying? I mean, probably not. They're not really getting anything out of it except making their elite happy. And their elite then can say, look, you made me happy. And
right. Or they'll say, don't swarm this guy, but.
Right.
Hey, this person tweeted at me. Don't be mean to them, but also.
Right.
I think you kind of saw some of that. You know, and it's a tool. It can be used for good or for ill. It doesn't necessarily always, you know, it is just a tool. It is power, and that, you know, power can be wielded in a multitude of directions. As we continue to talk through that stuff, I'm thinking, again, to date the podcast a little bit, the H Bomber guy,
yeah.
4-hour video about, hey, how how queer culture is getting co-opted and plagiarized, you know, directly by a specific individual. Where that individual was viewed as an elite in that space, but also H Bomber guy is an elite in that space. And like, okay.
Well, like this fascinating situation where, you know, the individual in question that H Bomber guy, you know, pointed out the issues that this person engaged in, you know, a white cis male, but gay.
Right.
So, you know, absolutely has in other rooms probably dealt with a lot of really, really terrible shit.
Right.
But in this particular space, literally stole words and honestly money out of the mouths of queer, black, brown, femme creators that he just took their work wholesale and did not give them credit, did not give them compensation. He made a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we talk through that stuff, right, it's you know, H. Bomber guy, as he made the video that also pointed out that these things happen. That's also power, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
One of those audiences was bigger than the other one, too.
Yeah.
It's not an easy, you know, it's an easy concept as you start to grasp it. And that's what felt like the brain started to really trigger and work through this stuff. Taiwo does a lot of stuff with game theory also as we talk through, like, hey, let's visualize how this works. One of the primary ones used a lot early with Elite Capture is... the Emperor Has No Clothes, right?
Yes.
Hey,
yes.
If you're stupid, you can't see the clothes. So everyone pretends to see the clothes until someone finally calls it out. But, you know, that situation is complicated. That is not just everyone pretending for the benefit because they don't want to seem stupid. Maybe there's other influences and powers at play. It's not just an intellectual thing. It is, hey, if you're, you know, as Taiwo points out, the baker and the baker on the street,
yes,
that the king walks down probably has that bakery on the street. The king walks down on purpose. So you probably don't fuck with the person who's making sure that you get paid.
Yes.
And it's these systems really start to compound as you think about them more and more and more and how some of this power has direct influence.
Yeah, I loved that metaphor. And one of the things that I really, really thought was incredibly well done is the way that he then folds that metaphor into a discussion about slavery and narratives that came out, especially like right post Civil War, like Reconstruction, where things are getting real weird. And he points out that a lot of scholars at the time used the fact that there weren't all these noted uprisings, and it seemed like you have all of these black individuals who are going along with what their master says. And I was like, well, because that's the emperor, and you're not going to tell your master you've got no clothes when the direct result of that is you will be whipped and maybe killed.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you're going to say that emperor, those clothes, they look real nice.
Wow, that looks great on you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, pointing out that the power dynamics make a difference in the ways in which people can and can't engage in conversations. So you may not be willing to push back against something that you know is wrong or push something that you know is right when your livelihood and your very existence depends on you being safe, and you making those proclamations makes you unsafe.
Yeah, the scenarios that we've used so far to talk through this stuff we're kind of led in with the allegory of the Emperor Has No Clothes and some of the social media stuff. And then we get into more of the political ramifications of some of those very ideas too, right? This is not just social media influence. This is the whole thing, right? This is how politics and specific things operate inside of larger systems of power, which include political systems. Specifically around capitalism and democracy and how can these two systems reside and how much influence does one have over the other? A lot. Turns out a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Taiwo points out as part of that social media conversation that, there were tons and tons of social media influencers targeting Christians and African Americans on Facebook and Instagram, and it turned out they were largely troll farms, and they were troll farms that were targeting these folks and attempting to rile them up by pushing narratives about, like, hey, here are the ways in which your culture doesn't love you, and here are the ways in which you're separate, and attempting to sow division to make those folks more amenable to things that would tear the system down, to make the system and the foundation of the system a bit more crackable.
Taiwo doesn't talk about it, but I've been thinking about it a lot lately of, I don't know enough about it to talk more about it, but I just read another article because the flat earth movement, right? Some of these other concepts, if you look at who's usually targeted with these things and what they're led to believe and how some of these specific conspiracy theories work and who it's influencing and why they're believing on it, you'll see a repeating pattern in a lot of these things, huh?
yeah, absolutely. And I think to that point, I've been thinking not necessarily specifically about the flat earthers, but sort of conspiracy theories and folks who sort of like fall prey to those more generally. And I think part of what we will get to eventually in this book is a more constructive view of what to do here. And I think that is an important part of how we deal with those sorts of things. And I think Taiwo gives us a little brief glimpse at that towards the end. But at this point, do we think we have a pretty decent idea of what an elite is and what elite capture is?
Yeah, I would say so. And we've talked a little bit about, specifically what their influence is and how their influence can work. Especially around the types of systems in question that Taiwo talks through. I'm trying to make sure I'm scrolling through really quick to see if there's anything else on here that we got to get through. And we talked about the scale, right? Hey, it's everything from small to full political structures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think perhaps this is one of the last things that I have highlighted for that particular chapter. A bit at the end, Taiwo quotes someone named Streak about the end of democracy, saying that it is simply the gradual capture of the political by the elites. As one crisis followed the next and the fiscal crisis of the state unfolded alongside them, the arena of distributional conflict shifted, moving upwards and away from the world of collective action of the citizens and towards ever more remote decision sites where interest appeared as problems in the abstract jargon of technocratic specialists. So essentially pointing out that the way that a lot of this works is taking the power, and you can see this a lot with unions, and we talked a little bit earlier last year. About the actors and writer strike. We saw a lot of collective action and union mobilization last year, more than we've seen in decades. And part of what we have seen happening over, really since the 80s, probably even since before then, is a gradual erosion of power of unions, and that power center that really does have to do with the individual and the collective group and moving up towards union leaders and congresspeople and technocratic elites.
Right.
So these folks who will say, I am in the room for the collective, but don't necessarily share the objectives of the collective. This is part of what was incredibly frustrating with the way that unions went during the Clinton administration, where there was like a real decision to turn it into more of like a boardroom style relationship, where the union leadership acted like another government agent instead of acting as an agent for the actual workers.
Yeah. And that's part one. We'll come back with the rest of the book. We will be right back.
All right. And we are back to discuss more Elite Capture.
The next two parts of the book are kind of about the systems and the power structures and kind of how they work, which are the next two parts, which is reading the room and being in the room, which they're pretty, we were just talking about this during the break. They're pretty complementary ones. Hey, we got to build this idea and then now we're going to work through that idea. Chris, you have many things highlighted. I will continue to refer back to you as the, again, I'm scrolling through the Kindle quickly. So let's talk a little bit about reading the room. I think I kind of gave some of that away when we talked about the structures of power with the emperor clothes thing.
Yes, yes, yes. But I think the first thing I actually want to talk about with reading the room, which is something that we talked a little bit before we started recording, as one of the key and most important concepts in this book, is the idea of the common ground. That's Tywell gets at that pretty early on in the second chapter, and I think it's a really, really important concept. I think it's a compelling concept, and I think it is directly applicable to what we're doing here on this podcast. So, Justice, what was your sense of the common ground? What did you take away from that?
So I really like definitions. I love, and we talked about, hey, for context, I read this book twice, or listened to this book twice. I did one listen right before you showed up, and I read it while I was making pasta for Christmas over the holiday.
Perfect.
And it turns out it was really more enjoyable when I wasn't stressed about how many eggs I had. But the thing that I really like that the book does, and it's what I liked the first time, is defining things like common ground. Which common ground is the idea. I love language. I love language so much. Like, common ground is, if you've ever played Monikers, the game, mm-hmm. and you come up with shared language and understanding that you can just assume.
Uh-huh,
so you build a small set of words, and then you cut that down into, instead of playing password, then you just play you say a single thing, and everyone has the shared understanding and common ground and shared vocabulary.
Uh-huh.
And then you can just do charades with anything in there, and everyone understands exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Like, is a perfect example of common ground.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, if you've ever played Monikers, the game, that is kind of the shared cultural understanding that whenever we say something, it means this thing. We've seen words now. There are, as Chris was informing me before the show, specific movements designed to make words worthless. You hear a lot of things also when we talk about like specific native groups. Hey, this native group has 60 words for snow, right? Well, they see snow all the fucking time. They got to know what the fuck the snow is,
yeah, right.
right? And you can't just say snow.
Right.
It's like, well, this is the slushy snow. This is the shitty snow. This is sleet. We have a word for sleet, like in English, so we know what the fuck sleet means. This is a wider, broader context of, or when I say we're recording a podcast,
mm-hmm.
Chris knows, shit, I better grab my microphones. and whenever Chris says, you should read this book, I go, shit, I got to read this fucking book now. It's not really, I got to do it. He's usually right. I haven't found a situation where he's wrong yet. So, yeah, I really like that. Like, it works a lot. It's not just, hey, with individuals, because we talk about this a lot at the broader cultural level.
Yes.
It's part of what this whole thing is. Us drinking and talking about this. Do you know that this thing is actually like, it does this, and it's incredible that this thing does this.
Yes.
And to define that, and hey, here's the vocabulary term, and here's usually why we think that these things are interesting, and what did they add and influence? It's building that common ground, and that's, oh, I love that shit.
Yes. Oh, agreed. It is. it is a wonderful concept and an incredibly useful concept. And I think part of what I love about it is the, particularly the way that he deals with it in these next two chapters, is the recognition that the common ground, just like some other stuff that we've talked about today, it is not something that is set in stone. You don't have a common ground where, well, we can define the common ground as these 10 things and everybody knows it. And for the rest of time, these 10 things will always be these 10 things. The common ground shifts based on cultural norms and understandings. And I think a very, very key point is that in different groups, different common ground will be established and will be useful. And I think one of the things that makes our current climate very difficult is the assumption that we're all operating off of the same common ground, when very clearly some people are not. And some people are actively attempting to undermine the common ground. I'm thinking specifically, this is the example I mentioned to you earlier, Justice. There's an activist, an author, and now a president or something of a college in Florida, because named Chris Rufo, who has made it his project to undermine the language and the terminology of the left, to take words that the left uses and has been using for constructive means, and to literally just like drive them into like obscurity, or to make them into something so toxic or so like incomprehensible that they're no longer useful. So things like woke, like things like identity culture, like that sort of thing, that is specifically, or those are specifically the kinds of terms that he is attempting to remove the context from and put a new, very, very rightward bent to make that common ground something different than what the left would like it to be.
Right. You see this a lot. And like, this is not a new play. Words have power. They are important. What things are called, what things mean, are important. I'm really bad at this because I use similes and metaphors all the time because I require shared understanding. That's how my brain works. But yeah, as you see these terms kind of get skewed and twisted, it's damaging. I grew up, I've talked about this before, I am a twin, right? I have had a shared context with another human being for 18 years of our life. Right. We were side by side for fucking everything. And then we went to college, you know, we pretty much had the same friends all the time too. And then we went and became other people, and our shared context broke down to a point that we've had physical altercations because the thing that he was saying is a thing that I also agreed with only slightly. And that was a problem. So like it's damaging.
Yes.
It's damaging to the relationship. It's damaging to the group that is utilizing a shared understanding, especially as these things start to skew and you thought you were talking about the same thing and you're not.
Yes.
That has direct influence on how well some of these things are going to continue to adapt and go.
Yes. And on the one hand, I wanted to call out Chris Rufo because I think it's important for people to know who he is and what his agenda is. And I also want to point out that I don't think that Chris Rufo is like an inherently evil human. I think that Chris Rufo firmly believes in his heart of hearts that the thing that he's doing is right. I think he actually believes the thing
that
he's
selling. You don't plan to do that.
Yes.
You know, especially if you're already, you know, this doesn't directly benefits him in the long run. But
right.
Like, he's not making money off of fucking up the word woke.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And so
maybe eventually. But like the direct day-to-day influence.
Exactly. And my sense is that financially he's doing well enough that like he doesn't really need that. But regardless, like I think this is a project that he has endeavored on because he also believes that culture is important. And one of the things that concerns me is if we don't have people pushing back against the narrative that he's pushing, then suddenly that does become the common ground. And I think it's very important for us to like you said, Justice, we here at Cultural Fugazi love language, and we think it's important. And so I don't want to see that language get devalued and become less useful without there being something to take its place or some attempt made to make sure that we salvage the good things and don't let that stuff fall by the wayside. So there's that.
Yep.
On the one hand. I do also think that, you know, Rufo might be the extreme example of that, but I think part of the reason we like to talk about and have talked about a bunch of movies, but culture in general, is that there are subtle ways that this happened that are not nearly as like clearly ideologically motivated as someone like Chris Ruffo. Like, I can point to him and be like, here's what he's doing. Here's his agenda. Here are the terms and the things that he's attempting to do it to. But we can also look at something like RoboCop and be like, well, what ways does this continue to push the narrative that the police are good? And which ways does it push back against that narrative? Because that is also cultural common ground. And that is cultural common ground that the writer and director didn't necessarily purposely put in there, but it's in there for reasons. And I think getting to the bottom of why that even becomes the common ground and like looking at what is even the common ground is something that we generally are interested in, even above and beyond the more egregious examples of where common ground has gone astray, like the Chris Ruffos of the world.
Yeah. Even Top Gun, for example, yeah. Right? Like, hey, you want to talk about like, hey, what did Top Gun do for the Air Force? And like, how do people think about pilots? People, whenever you say pilots, you're probably thinking of Top Gun. 9 times out of 10. Things as that seem as innocuous as, I don't, that's not the right word. Maybe it is. I don't know. We've used it. We're moving on. things as subtle or as small as like the Cleveland Air Show, right?
Yep.
It is military propaganda.
Yep.
You know, like you just got to, but do you think about it whenever your kid says, I like the plane, or whenever you see the plane fly over the baseball game, or you say you sing the national anthem before every sporting event or athletic activity or whatever, like these are cultural norms, and it doesn't, I'm not saying dismantle them all. Like that's not the implied thing. I think there's other reasons you would stop doing the Cleveland Air Show other than it's military propaganda. It has more to do with the way that it influences air quality in the region during the air
birds,
show.
The poor birds.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah. And we're only one day away from Bird Day, right? Bird Day was yesterday. The
it
day,
was.
Yeah, we were recording this. But there's plenty of other reasons why, but like the shared on, but also that's someone's culture.
Yes.
Someone goes to the air show every year. So like to operate with the shared understanding of, hey, I think from an air quality perspective, we don't need this anymore. Or to counterpoint someone saying, I can't wait to go to the 4th of July fireworks. You should be like, well, maybe baseball stadiums shouldn't have fireworks every night. But also if I'm buying tickets to a baseball game that has a fireworks night, I'm fucking staying for fireworks night. They're going to put them off whether or not I'm there or not.
Right.
Right. Like
right.
That, those are going to happen. So, no, I, you and I love shared ground or, you know, common ground so much. Like we, the other book club, we only allow ourselves to talk about books that we have read in context with the book club for the most part. So like,
that's true.
We do
with like a couple of very large exceptions.
Yeah. Like, hey, we, to talk about all these fantasy books, we will mention the Wheel of Time because we know that we've all read a lot of the Wheel of Time, but
and
also
like Tolkien. Look, if you have a fantasy, if you're talking fantasy period,
right. But, and we don't have, we haven't book club that yet. Not saying we won't, but you know, some of the stuff there of like, hey, well, but as it pertains to this book and this book and this book, and we're getting in a list that's long enough now, we're 60 books in for book club.
Yeah.
I know we're post 50.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
That
yeah.
list is getting long enough now that that common ground is sliding out from underneath some of us, especially those of us that are bad at remembering shit. me specifically. But, you know, it's like some of that stuff can be, oh, right, we read this.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. So as far as it pertains to rooms, right? So so whenever we talk about, hey, reading the room, it's a lot of that common ground and understanding what it is that we're talking about, and then being in the room and having that influence on it. You know, those are, I think we've kind of already talked about a little bit of both. I don't know how much more you have to add to being in the room or these room concepts in general.
So I think we've definitely handled, I think, reading the room, because the common ground really is... That is partially the room. The room is also partially, you know, spaces that you have access to or spaces that you don't necessarily have access to. Like I am not, weirdly enough, they haven't asked me to show up on Congress and
not
make
yet.
A bunch of decisions.
Yeah. Not with that attitude.
You know what? You're right. Maybe this will be the year.
This is the one.
Who knows? but, you know, like just as you mentioned before, I have been a manager before. And so there were certain rooms that I was in as a manager, certain managerial meetings that were specifically literally a room just full of managers. And the room had a shared context of people who manage people and the power that comes along with that and the responsibilities that come along with that. But also sometimes the lack of perspective that comes along with being on the level of a manager and not necessarily being one of the employees doing the day-to-day in-and-out work to keep the lights on. So that defines the room, too. There is a certain common ground that you have with those managers that's going to be different than the common ground that the analysts have or the workers have. That's going to be different than the common ground that somebody who doesn't have a job has. So there are different rooms, but ultimately each room is going to have its own context and its own common ground. So good to understand that.
Yeah. I don't remember, as far as sections go, when we talk about deference politics. Is that in being in the room, or is that later on in building the house?
So that is section three. Being in the room.
I'm just, at 2x speed, some things blur together. Yeah. So.
And I love the deference politics conversation so much.
So are we good to move on to part three, building the new house? Let's do it.
Yeah. Well, aren't we? Isn't this is being in the room?
Being in the room. Yeah. Oh yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, we're not quite building a house yet.
Not yet. Sorry.
Yes, but
I got excited.
Yes, let's talk about some deference.
Yeah. So one of the things I think Taiwo does a great job is pointing out. Flint, Michigan, right? Drinking water and what it means to talk to all these people who live in Flint and, let them kind of lead, talk through their experience and how, they've been traumatized by this and what this does. And to then separate that from talking about this stuff is definitely a thing.
Yes.
But also that does not get them clean drinking water.
Yes.
And, always referring back to his whole take on trauma and how trauma, being the most traumatized does not, and how he looks back on his specific trauma where he says, I take that I am, I am proud of my stoicism and how I've survived that. That does not make me the most qualified person to solve a problem that is related to my trauma. And trauma can have negative influences because, hey, the word is literally trauma.
Yeah,
it is traumatic, right? It is a lived experience that is challenging to you as an individual, regardless, whatever that trauma is. It is hard.
Yes.
That does not always put you as the best person. And that may be a controversial take that you might not be the best person, especially someone who has directly been influenced by that trauma, to have the best opinion about how to resolve the traumatic event. And we know this and a thousand other situations, but as it pertains to activist circles and some of these, especially, modern, even, inherently leftist thought processes of how do you get the people who are experiencing the terrible thing through the terrible thing as a joint community? If you are only passing the mic to them, and only allowing them to speak, hey, they're in the room and they get to be there, and that's great. The more that you defer away from the problem doesn't solve the problem.
Well, and brings up the very important point that the people that are already in the room are probably not the ones that you need to be talking to. A couple of quotes that I want to read from the book directly dealing with this specific thing, because I think, again, Taiwo does a really, really wonderful job with this. So first off, instead, centering the most marginalized, in my experience, has usually meant handing the conversational authority and attentional goods to whoever is already in the room and appears to fit a social category associated with some form of oppression, regardless of what they have or have not actually experienced or what they do not actually know about the matter at hand. So, hey, managers,
yep,
do we have a black manager in the room? Good. Tell us what the black people need. No!
Let's even lower the stakes on that a little bit, too, of managers. You are the voice for all of your employees.
Yes. Yes.
Are you?
Right.
I do a lot of, hey, my team knows a lot of this way more than I do, in meetings now. Now that I've stepped away from the work for longer, I do a lot of, I'll have to ask them. And some people don't do that. Some people say, I know exactly what's going on and allow me to, you know, to say these thoughts, right? And that's the lower stakes version of that.
Yeah.
And we know that that happens.
Yep.
Right? So just keep, you know, as we talked earlier about the scope of and the impact of all these things. So make that room bigger.
Yeah.
Make that room Congress.
Yeah.
Right? How, you know, you're the black congressman. Solve all of racism.
Yes.
Hey, you're the black president. Solve racism.
Yeah. And I think so. This is definitely an area where, oh, man, there is a ton of really, really, really great reading that you can do around this particular concept. This is one of the areas where Fanon like shines. Like a lot of Fanon's work deals specifically with the black bourgeois and the idea that the black bourgeois embraces a bunch of the same thoughts and the same patterns that the white, like often like slave owners or colonizers or power structures, it embraces that line of thinking and essentially assumes, no, this, the white folks have it right. We just need to be more like them. And as long as we do the white thing well enough, then we will succeed. And so if you ask those folks, that black bourgeois, hey, what should we do to help black people? They'll be like, well, just help make them be more like white people, and then it'll be fine. It's like, no, that's not what they want or need. Please don't do that. And Fanon gets into a ton of that in The Wretched of the Earth, Black Skin, White Masks. Like, I would recommend both of those if you want to do a much more intense theoretical dive.
Yeah. I think some of that is the history lesson that as part of what Taiwo outlines through the book, right, is here's what this can mean and what this is and what the ramifications for having the wrong people or having these people in the room and what they think is the right, you know, who are the people making decisions and what is their context and what is their background and what are the decisions that they're making and how that can actually fundamentally fail political structures, right? Like, hey, if you put everyone who knows that, you know, if they don't break ties off from their, if they have a revolution and they don't break the specific revolutionary ties to the previous way that specific things used to work, then you're going to fall into a similar system under a different name, which is, when you say it out loud, seems super simple. If I told you that I'm going to work out every day, and then I staged a coup against myself that said, no, I'm not. And then I also said, but, you know, maybe I'm still going to go on a lot of walks and listen to a lot of audiobooks. I'm still working out every day, right? Like, so, like, if you don't break down and you kind of separate yourself from these foundational systems, you're going to see repeating patterns if you're operating under the same context. And, you know... shared understanding, common ground, you know, what's the end goal for a lot of these groups? Hey, the end goal for a lot of people is self-preservation. There's nothing usually inherently wrong with that, but it becomes self-preservation of power and of power structures in place where you have power. And they usually look like, especially the elites, as they've been outlined, they like things to usually stay the same. You know, large scale radical change is usually not good for the currently in power, regardless of the scope and scale of that. If all the employees stop showing up to work tomorrow, that's bad for the manager, right? If your country stages a revolution out from under you, that's bad for you as a political leader, right?
Yeah,
you know, a little bit
great.
Of different scope.
Yeah.
If you're playing a game of Risk and the entire table decides to team up on you, you're gonna have a bad time, right? So that's kind of the thing that I think we build into a lot of these historical, and we build this, it's built into the book to provide you some historical context for kind of what some of these things are. Personal opinion about the book, this is kind of what I struggled with the most, is that I think it's the second time through, I was way more on board with it. But the first time through, I kind of struggled with the, we're getting the good, what my brain likes. I love the vocabulary shit, right? I want to talk about what these things are and how they mean. I don't do as well with historical context. I just don't. Like, We're in book three of the Malazan for book club, and I don't remember shit that happened in the Malazan, let alone things that actually happened on planet Earth anywhere. I could probably tell you more about the Malazan, but there's also like cool ancient swords and shit.
Yeah. I mean, generally just assume that there was a god who disappeared, who's back now doing some stuff.
Think of the coolest shit all the time. Yeah. That's the rule of the Malazan. Think of the coolest shit all the time. That is what happens usually.
Yes.
That's not true for planet Earth.
No.
It's usually not the coolest shit. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
So to have that understanding is useful and good. It's just not what my brain likes. So I was looking for some of the historical context to like bridge the gap from vocabulary words to seeing it in context and seeing that meaning, and then kind of doing the next bit of that to drive home another point.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of just use that as part of the vocabulary lesson and we move on. At least that's how I took it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, it's great. It worked, obviously. I know what some of these things are.
Right.
It's just not what my brain likes to enjoy. I'm good with just the vocabulary stuff. And if we talk about it a little bit and we can kind of move on. And Taibo does such a great job of the game theory stuff. And I'm on board with that. Then to show the real world examples of these things at a larger scale. Yes, that is important and good.
Mm-hmm.
My brain kind of went, well, it's kind of boring. the first time through. The second time through, I was like, oh, no, I get it. Like, I get it.
Right.
First time through, we had this conversation. I was very drunk for New Year's where I was like, ah, I'm just not crazy about it. And that was some of the same stuff that I had, you know, as always, I crowdsource half my opinions on Goodreads, of the Goodreads review of the book. And that's one of the things that I was like, I think that was also what I thought. And then I read it again and I was like, no, you fucking idiot. you know what he's doing. This is fine.
Fantastic.
So yeah, that's where some of that stuff came from is as I finished it and I put it on Goodreads like a good boy. I was like, oh, well, maybe I think that way too. And I was like, no, you fucking moron. And those people are elites, and they influenced my opinion. And I had to decide they were wrong.
You got captured.
Yep, I got captured.
But you freed yourself. Look at that.
Yep.
I think that's... It's. I was super curious when you were like, I don't know, I like this book. I was like, oh, man, now I really want to have this conversation even more, because I was very curious, like, which parts and what about it did fall flat. In part because, as we've discussed, there's a lot of the message and the vocabulary that's great.
Yeah.
It's really good. And I can see how a lot of the historical examples would be harder to get through. Like, at this point now, I'm like, well, I know now. And this is another book that if you are curious about some of these kinds of concepts, I would recommend. But, Justice, I am not going to give you Angela Davis's, what is it, Race, Women, and Class, or Women, Race, and Class, because... That's just the history, and it's really good.
Well, I can kind of do just history.
Okay.
So, like, I just finished Sellout, which is kind of just history of, like, bands and stuff like that. I'm trying to read, I think it's on my Kindle right now, the book about labor, I think, that I sent you.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and that's mostly the historics, like, the historic context of, like, labor movements in America. That stuff, when it's just that stuff, all right, and I just finished... The guy who wrote Killers of the Flower Moon, The Wager.
I
just finished The Wager, which was great. So when it's kind of just that stuff, which eventually also gets into like the, hey, all these people died, and when you really think about what they died for, it's kind of fucking really sad, huh? Like, this is all just the British imperial system, like, swinging fully into effect and failing. They failed at being imperialists, and now all these people are dead. But don't worry, they got better at imperialism. So less of these boys died, however the rest of planet Earth suffered. And it was like, oh, man.
Ouch.
Anyway, so, like, I can do that. I just wasn't... I think it's where my brain was at, like, mm-hmm. I said, was thinking about how many eggs in my first batch of dough didn't come out good, and I think that influenced my first reading of the... my first listening of the book, if you will.
Oh, that's pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. So, in that case, perhaps...
I perfected the pasta recipe, by the way.
Oh, great.
Like, I really figured out what went wrong. I tried to do like a whole egg instead of just an egg yolk. You don't eat eggs, so you don't care. but I did a whole egg, which means you're going to have more moisture and the dough. So I used less and I was like, oh, and then I was also doing a double batch. And that's where I fucked up, is I changed two things at the same time. Never do that.
You've ruined the science.
Yeah. So I went back and I made two single batches of the regular egg yolk instead of the egg white. Had a lot of egg whites that I didn't have anything to do with.
Great.
So yeah, and now that I'm happier, now that we're post holiday and I read it while playing, some absolute garbage dungeon crawlers on the Switch.
Perfect. Like,
everything was good. The numbers were going up in the way that I want the numbers to go up. During all that downtime of all the numbers going up, book was happening.
You're like, oh yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm thriving.
Tell me more about.
Yeah. Yeah. Put me in a blanket. I'm thriving. I'm living my best life at that point in time.
Well, excellent. In that case, that I would recommend Angela Davis then.
Yeah.
Which, so that does get into some, I think part of what you end up reckoning with The Room is the idea that the people who make it into the room make it into the room because they have been selected for the room. And that's not necessarily, I think it's also a really key and important facet of this book that there is like no like evil like overlord in the background being like, ha ha ha, we will
fuck
only,
this. Yeah.
Only let the white men in the rooms. Like, no, there are systems that happen and then they get reinforced by the elites once the elites get into power. And yep. If the elites are all white dudes, then the white dudes are going to want to keep the white dudes in power. So like that ends up being a self-reinforcing mechanism. And so the room ends up being shaped by those forces.
Yeah.
And so part of what you end up seeing is you don't get poor black people in management positions because they don't have the resources necessary to be able to play the game well enough to do the stuff that you need to do to get into those rooms.
Yeah.
So why aren't they in those rooms, and what does it mean for them not to be in those rooms? If you don't have anything else for being in the room.
Does, I can't remember which chapter it happens in, does Taiwo do the, he does that entire great example of the black merchants group.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Actually, you have reminded me. I wanted to talk about Jay-Z.
Of course. Dramatic pause. I'm going to write this timestamp down so you can say, I wanted to talk about Jay-Z, and I'll throw in a cut. Yes, you wanted to take your sip of bourbon, and then we'll talk about Jay-Z. That feels pretty elitist to say. Sorry, don't spill.
No, it's exactly how Jay-Z would want it. So that to me was so that happens in part based on some of the conversations that have to do with some of the Fanon stuff that he brings up about the black bourgeoisie. So you end up having the idea that, hey, if we're black and wealthy, if we accumulate money, if we create banks for ourselves, if we take the tools of capitalism and turn them to our favor, then we'll be fine. Everything will be good. All of our problems will be solved. And I mentioned Jay-Z because there are few bigger advocates for black entrepreneurship than Jay-Z. He truly believes that the answer to fixing the ghetto, to allowing black folks to live in harmony with white folks, is just everybody get rich. Just get rich. Make some cash. Make some money. Once you make some money, then you're good. Then you've got the power. Then, and the thing that fails to recognize is all you've done is buy access into specific rooms that are still only limited to a very specific group of people. And you haven't changed the room to make it easier for anybody else like you to get into the room. You just happened to be rich enough so that you could get access into some of these rooms. And you don't even get access into all of them. You get access into some of them. It's very much that kind of thing where, hey, bad news, Bill Cosby. Doesn't matter how rich you are, you're still a black man and they're still going to throw you in jail.
Right. Right. I think with that, I think we see some of that around the you know, building a new house, right? Where the one women's group ended up, you know, they were put as part of a presidential, you know, they were put in a group. Hey, these black women of color, or you know, are going to do, or that's a, said the same word twice, you know what I mean? But they were going to do this group, and then they were put together by like a presidential commission to start this group, and then they left that group and started a different group.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that is, we will, I will make sure that we have a link to a PDF of the statement from this group. This is one of like, this is the birth of the term identity politics.
Yeah.
So this is the Combahee River Collective.
Yep.
And yes, they split off. It's a JFK initiative that originally was supposed to be about like, how do we expand opportunities for women? And a bunch of queer black women were like, hey, this conversation doesn't work because we're really not considering black queer perspectives. And we should do that. Like, if anything, we're uniquely positioned to see the ways that this system breaks down because we are most keenly impacted by the worst aspects of the broken parts of the system. So part of their idea was, hey, we can use this these identity markers as tools to rally around and as mechanisms to point out the ways in which the system isn't meeting everybody's needs. And so it wasn't supposed to be, and this is one of the things that is the most frustrating to me in the world when I hear it, the idea that the point of identity politics is to make it clear that I am better than you because I am black and I am queer, and that puts me higher on the totem.
I mean, it does. You're, if you're usually cooler, you're at least cooler. Probably. You're probably having a more fun weekend. But not all the time.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, the idea behind the collective was to use, essentially, and to throw in some more reading homework, there's this book called Racecraft by the Field Sisters, who they get to a bunch of essays together in this book that a lot of them have this idea around race that is less, hey, don't get caught up in the idea that you are a black person. Recognize that the idea of blackness is something that's in opposition to whiteness, and that we're using that term because we have to, because there are material realities that make the term useful. We aren't saying that black people should be separate from white people. We are saying that they effectively are separate from white people. And we would like that, we'd like that to change. But if we pretend that they're not separate, then we don't have the ability to fix the problems that are preventing those two groups from actually being able to be on the same page. So identity is a useful tool to use to identify the areas in which the monoculture, the big culture, is maybe not paying as close attention to the needs of minority groups or smaller pockets within that culture.
And I think that kind of takes us into part four, building a new house. What a segue. Way to go.
Look at that.
Yeah.
So yeah, what do you do when it turns out that the...
All hope is lost.
The rooms, they weren't made for you, and you're not allowed in. They won't give you the keys.
So some of these later sections of the book, one of the things Taiwo says early on is that he's not going to provide answers, but this is, I think, where we get into a lot of the historical context and kind of what he points to is a lot of the times where I'm just going to make a new room, or we're going to change some of the scales of power. This is where a lot of this stuff comes in. And I guess, again, my only real quibble with this thing was I was looking for, you know, I kind of wanted some, hey, here's some of this stuff right now and a little bit less of the historical stuff. But the quibble aside, I've never written a book before, you know, so fuck me. So that, that's one of those things that I was looking for more of, but there's great examples in this of kind of like, yeah, how do you solve this problem? And how do we, you asked me the question. I'm going to ask it back to you, Chris.
All
I'm
right.
going to defer. I'm going to use my deferring politics technique as all white people do. And I'm going to ask the black man how we solve this problem.
Well, you know, deference politics had to come for me eventually. So, no, I'm happy to field this question because it gives me the opportunity to talk about one of my favorite books in the world, Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Okay.
As part of the historical example that Taiwo brings up is the example of Paulo Freire's work to change education, to make a more yes. liberal version of education in the PAIGC. And the work to essentially set up structures of dual power. New term. Mm. Wasn't in the book. Going to throw it out because it is a useful term, and it is essentially the thing that Taiwo was talking about. So what is dual power? Dual power is when you recognize that there might be structures within the system, like schools or like hospitals, that because of often elite capture or because of various ways in which they discriminate against certain groups, might not be serving the communities that need them the most. So what if, as a community, you say, well, we're going to build our own schools. We're going to set up our own clinics. We're going to go ahead and we're going to set up alternate sources of power to take care of these things for us. So we're not going to break down the existing mechanisms for these things. We don't necessarily think that we should destroy education or destroy healthcare. Instead, we're going to make sure that we're getting our needs taken care of by setting up this dual power structure. So that is a lot of what Freire does in his actual work. And the book Pedagogy of the Oppressed is a wonderful work to read, particularly if you are someone who does have, you know, some of these, who maybe is a bit of an elite, or maybe you are a, hey, you're in America, you're listening to this podcast, you are better off.
You're at least hearing it in English.
Yes. You're already better off than a lot of other people in the world. So how do you, if you want to help those people, how do you approach that in a way that isn't going to be paternalistic, that isn't going to just be trying to force them into your room and trying to force them to conform with your room, even though that room might not work for them? So Pedagogy of the Oppressed is very much about, well, no, let's expand the room. Let's talk to those people and find out what they need in the room. Like, do we need to, like, take out a wall and, like, maybe expand the size of the room? Do we, like, maybe need some couches because there are some folks who can't walk as well and they need a place to sit? What can we do to make this room more hospitable? And that might even mean make another room.
Yeah. Especially whenever that room has power.
Yes.
Right? Like, you know, the things that you're talking about are specifically, like, institutionalized change.
Yes.
And that stuff really works well. You know, schools are incredibly powerful. Again, not to keep harping on the thing that has happened recently with Harvard. you know, regardless of whether or not Harvard is powerful or not, it is viewed as a powerful institution. And how people are educated inside of it. You know, early childhood care, like, earlier yes. is way more powerful than later education, especially as it, you know, builds foundations for continued learning and all that stuff. But the long and the short of it is, you know, education is a useful institution. Also, it doesn't hurt that you and I are both college educated.
Yep.
The book we are reading is from a professor,
yep.
right? And he even calls himself out specifically as, we're going to talk about the ivory tower because some of these things are things that I can directly, you know, talk through.
Yep.
So, yeah, the stuff there was, I you asked me this question, which I found funny because I was like, no, you fucking read this book. Like, that's funny.
Well, I wanted to give you an opportunity to say something before I went on my rant about Paulo Freire.
Before you built better common ground than me going like, I don't know. I mean, like, I think, yeah. I think that that's a really powerful, great example, of this thing really working. What I was looking for a little bit also is some of that more context of about what I can do in the positions that I hold to. But again, that's some bias, right? you know, like, not everything has to be that. But I
think that's a really good question to have, though. I think that's a very good. I think it's good that you ended up in that spot. I think that is precisely the place that you should end up.
Right.
And I think it's good that you're frustrated about it because that means you want to do things. So
there's not a lot I can offer most of the time for anything. But like, hey, if I can offer a little bit for anything, like, or even what are some of the ideas that, as I have opportunities to influence things, that I can influence those things towards a specific direction. There's a lot of not to do's.
Yes.
And I think the book does a really great job of being like, and here's some things that work. And here's a bunch of things that also don't work.
Yes.
Or and why change happened and what occurred. I'm kind of looking for a little bit more of the, not necessarily prescriptive, I don't need a prescriptive point of view, but some more keywords. Again, my brain loves that shit. Some more keywords to hang on to so that when I can hear people talking about specific terms that I can be like, well, I think I know what that term means and they're using it in the way that I like. And I can adhere to their agenda or follow along with what they're trying to accomplish and provide, you know, influence in whatever way that I can to get that done. And I think that's, for me, that's useful for me to be like, oh, hey, maybe you're coming at this from a position of power. And right. How can you turn those knobs and turn those dials?
I think that makes a ton of sense. And I think, so for me, part of what you get here in this book is the tools and the idea to, hey, examine the room that you're in and figure out the ways in which that room is not accessible. Like, figure out the areas where perhaps the room has been made unfriendly to certain people, certain types of people, certain groups of people, and think about if there are ways that you then can make the room more accessible. Because you're not going to be able to do that with every room, but there are going to be some rooms that you have more power and control over, and you can do more of this. And so I think the thing that you would then have been left with is, okay, but like...
But now, what?
What rooms? Hey, what do I do in the rooms?
Yeah, but hey, I'm in some rooms. I got a room. Hey, what do you want?
Do I need to buy new furniture? I'll buy new furniture.
I'll do the whole thing. I'll take the wallpaper down eventually. I promise. And I don't know if there's that much more to talk about until we get to, because this is, I think, the lead into the last section,
yes.
Which is, and I think he has answered my question already. With the name of the last section, right? It's part of the reason why on the reread, I was like, you fucking idiot. You moron. It's literally staring at you in the face. The point is to change it, which is the last section of the book.
Yes.
And kind of the, you know, that's the primary takeaway of, well, what are we doing? What do I do? And it's like, well, the point is to change it. When you see these things as you have the opportunity to do so, the point is to change it.
Yes.
And the scope and the scale of that, and I think that's the great thing that Taiwo does, is he builds multiple examples of what that means to do, right? You can do it at the smallest scale as the manager in the room. You could say, actually, we should call in some of the leads who work on this stuff.
Yes.
Or we should share, you know... I'm a manager, I'm a paper pusher, and the technical authority should come from the technical authorities, especially like in my form of IT work.
Yes.
I'm not the knowledgeable person of how a thing should be done. I'm literally in helping other people and influencing them to do that. So I'm not the right person in that room all the time. The point is to put the right people, not just from a deference perspective, but to really understand where the power structures lie and to align them to the right locations. And, you know, me stepping out of a room and putting someone else in there isn't always going to produce a better result.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the things that I really love about all of this taken sort of as a whole is the idea that... So, Justice, are you familiar with or has your workplace done any of these position statements or positionality statements?
For like individual like job structure stuff?
No. Okay. So this is a thing that I just recently started to see where particularly folks who are higher up on the food chain, you know, administrators, directors.
Yeah, I ain't that high, buddy.
Yeah. But also like managers are encouraged
to do it.
But the idea is that you essentially like write out all the ways like all of your identity characteristics and all the ways in which that like puts you in either a like position of power or I'm a white lady who lives on land that was from this tribe.
Oh, okay.
And I have a college degree, but I had blue collar parents. Like this idea of like essentially like running through your
what are your inherent biases because of the way that you were raised or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like a big thing that I've seen is also like then encouraging those folks to share that at the beginning of like presentations or meetings. And on the one hand, I think that the exercise of actually doing that analysis and thinking through that is good. That said, I don't need to know about it. Right. Don't tell me the ways in which you are privileged or not privileged, because that doesn't help me. It doesn't help people that have less power than me. It doesn't do anything to move the needle. And I think the thing that Taiwo points out, and this is part of the deference politics argument, is that we shouldn't be looking at, you know, identity or these markers as signs that we're doing the thing right. We should be looking at results. We should be looking at actions. Are you doing things that have a meaningful result that helps the people that you are trying to help? And you can't do that if you don't understand where you're positioned in the world and with other people. You can't do that if you don't understand your relationship with those people. But it can't stop there. And I think, to me, like, one of the things that is often frustrating about things like that and things about DEI initiatives is that they stop there. The point is, let us point to the identities, and we did it. We told you they exist. And now we're good.
Mm-hmm.
We've done our work. Great. And but have you looked at the pipeline for getting people into this organization? Have you done any work to make that pipeline more accessible? The people who are here, what are you doing to make them feel more comfortable being able to voice the ways in which perhaps things aren't working for them and systems are letting them down? And it's that kind of stuff that I think is where you get to building the house. Like, what are we doing to, like, renovate the house to make it fit the people that are that we actually want to show up there more comfortable? One of the advantages of a constructive politics, like the constructive politics that Taiwo advocates, is that you get to be positive about it. It can be a thing where, instead of being a, well, let's tear these people down. And I think often, like, I think to me, that's one of the areas that, like, that is a place where the Chris Rufos of the world are falling into a trap that is just as harmful and dangerous to them as it is to the rest of us. And, like, he just doesn't realize that. And a lot of, like, honestly, I read his book Cultural Revolution, or American Revolution, the book that he wrote about being woke in America. And it was very clear to me very, very quickly that that was a book that was written by somebody who is deeply, deeply scared. That is a very, very scared person. And the thing is that, like, that fear is true. Like, it's not like that fear doesn't exist. But taking that fear and then projecting it out into the world means that you get a destructive politics that's all about tearing things down. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't it be way better or way more interesting if the goal there was, how do I build things up so that the people and the things that I care about have more space in this world? Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that Taiwo was arguing for. Let's make more space for people. Not let's close these doors. The Rufos of the world want to close the doors. They want to batten the hatches down, and they want to guard against the quote-unquote barbarians. Taiwo was like, no, make it bigger. Expand the size of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Build
a second one if you need
to. Build a second one. Yes, absolutely. But make this a constructive politics where it is about finding solutions to problems and actually dealing with the things that are causing people to feel scared and to be upset and to not be able to live to their fullest. And that, to me, really, really hits at the optimistic take.
Yeah. I have to say... Kind of winding down here. I think we're winding down.
Mm-hmm.
This bourbon's finally empty on my side.
Yeah.
It's not on your side yet, but
almost.
Almost.
We're very close.
I would say that I'm really happy I read this, because a lot of terms, you know, again, to get back to what I said earlier, a lot of terms, a lot of things were a lot more clear to me. Especially, you know, it's so short. Reading it twice was harmless. It did slow me down on Malazan. That's a sacrifice I was willing to make. I think not only that, but talking through it with you, which that's the whole fucking point of the podcast. But, you know, talking through it with you, I think is a delight. There's big ideas here, right? There's big enough ideas to put them on paper and to talk through them. And nothing, I guess the other point to really say here is, I don't think there's anything here that we really disagreed with.
Yes.
From a foundational perspective. Right.
Yep.
And I would say that, you know, Taiwo calls out where a lot of these concepts and components come from.
Yes.
And you know, these are not, new ideas, just his collection of them and how he presents them is useful. And it's breezy. This is not written from a perspective. At one point in time, two things. At one point in time, he references Mario Kart.
Yeah, he does.
And he says, if you're losing at Mario Kart, you can just turn the console off. And that's bullshit. That's not the right thing to do if you're losing at Mario Kart, especially if you're playing with friends. It's a dick move.
Justice, you need to tell that to Chris Rufo.
Yeah, that's a dick move. You can't just fucking turn off Mario Kart. Like, there are stakes. Like, there's honor here. So that was the first thing. The second thing was he makes a reference to, like, games and games being fair. I think, like, right after the Mario Kart thing. And he says, you know, about, like, the rules of engagement and why people like to be in games, which just reminds me that I really fucking love, like, the concept of game and like philosophy.
Games are really good. We should talk about that more this year.
We should talk about it more this year. But he says something. And he says, you know, when we think about games, there's rules and things, and you know, everything can't be fair like baseball.
Okay. Actually, I'm glad that you go on.
Because that's not, baseball is not fair.
I thought about you when I read that. I was like, I bet Justice is going
to
have
some. Yeah, we have to talk about the New York fucking Yankees for, like, no, baseball is not fair. The Houston Astros got to keep the fucking trophy. Like, it's not a fair game. So the game of baseball, and I'm using quotes, the game of baseball even isn't supposed to be fair. It's an asynchronous game, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's not only is it asynchronous, but how good you are at one point of, or one part of the game, it doesn't matter how bad you are at the other part of the game. Like, literally being a pitcher means you don't have to be good at fucking anything else. Not a fucking thing.
Right.
That's not really true in, like, soccer. For the most part, in soccer, there's a lot of positions you can be way better at shooting on goal. But you kind of need to be generally good at the sport of soccer in all positions to kind of play at the high levels.
Mm-hmm.
A person who plays professional soccer on the defensive side is probably going to be all right if they played a pickup game in the park in a different position. Someone who only pitches may never be able to fucking hit a ball. You don't know.
Right.
Right? Like, that's what I mean, right? It's not a fair game. Right. No part of baseball is fair. So, sorry, that was a longer rant than I thought it was.
I am happy that you got the chance to get that off your chest. I did when I saw that in the book.
It's not fair. Yeah. So the two examples of games, the rest of them are fine, but the Mario Kart and the baseball stuff,
yeah.
I walked away disappointed.
Okay, so you agreed with everything in the book
except Mario.
Okay, yeah, great, perfect.
Turn the
perfect
fucking game. Like, oh man, imagine at a you're with your all of your friends in like a college dorm room, and you're playing Mario Kart 64, and you're behind, and you get up and fucking and you turn the thing off.
I mean, difficult for
riots would ensue.
I was gonna say difficult for me to imagine with friends, siblings.
Yeah,
oh, man.
Siblings. Ooh. Yeah, like, you're playing GoldenEye. There's three other people over.
Definitely never once a fight in my household based on anything even remotely like that.
Yeah, definitely,
never happens.
Definitely not someone losing at Street Fighter 2 and just fuck, or Mortal Kombat 3 and just hit the reset button. You go, what the fuck?
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's important. It was necessary to really dive into
that deep.
Yeah. So, at this point,
you recommended so a couple things.
Yes.
I want to do final thoughts.
Yes.
You also recommended a ton of books. I don't know if you have the bibliography
in front of you.
We're going to do the rundown one more time.
We'll have the books in the notes, and I will make sure that we have a link to the Combahee River Collective statement.
Yep.
So that
so
you can
Chris is
going to
write the show notes for the first time.
Yeah. Woo. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
I know, but I do have a bit of a bibliography that I think would be very useful. I will also throw in a plug. We didn't talk about it during the section because I kind of forgot about it, but I think Elite Capture, and at some point we should probably do an episode about this, but I think it fits kind of neatly into Mark Fisher's idea of capitalist realism. And
like, I'm going to shake my head yes, like I know what you're talking about.
You know what it is. We'll talk about it again.
Yeah.
But like the idea that capitalism eats up everything that and tries to oppose it.
Is a destructive force.
Yeah. So like I think some of that elite capture is how you make that happen. So we'll include a bunch of that in the show notes so you can do more reading if you want to, have a conversation with me about Fanon, I would love to have a conversation with anybody who listens to this about Fanon.
And you can email us, us@fugazipod.com, or hit us up on social media. We're on most of those. What I mean by most of those is Chris is on Blue Sky somewhere.
Yeah.
If you can find him, he's all yours.
I might start posting. So I will say that, we'll save it for final thoughts.
Okay. You can email us and let us know kind of where we were wrong, what you think, and we can yell at you. Or find us. We're not hard to find, probably by you, the listener at home. Find us and buy us a beer. We'll talk to you.
Yeah.
I'll listen to you be wrong. For at least one high life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sure. All right, final thoughts.
All right, so final thoughts. I will say reading this happened at a really, really nice time for me because I was starting to feel a little bit of that 2024 election year, already the malaise, the fatigue. The
ads are already on TV.
They are already on TV. It's inescapable now. Everything on the news is going to be a nightmare until November and probably afterwards too. So I was starting to feel a little bit down because I didn't know what to do. Like it's very hard for me to feel excited about the Democratic prospects this year, and I don't want to not do anything, so that doesn't feel great. It's like, well, what do I do? And reading this made it really clear to me that, well, expanding the room is something that needs to happen regardless of what happens with the election. This is work that you can do at home, at your job, with your friends. We have a part to play that all these tiny things can add up into big things. And so I now recognize my own power in this scenario and am going to try to do my best to really like embrace that and to use it for good. I mentioned at the top of the show that I'm really interested in doing more work with the library this year. Mm-hmm. Every time I think to myself, man, I would really like to do this thing because I think the community could use it, I look and the library's already doing it because the library is one of the best things that we have.
Yep.
They're amazing. Yep. They're wonderful.
You have one in your neighborhood or your city, I promise you.
And you can rent instruments from them. You can rent equipment from them
They have their own movie streaming shit.
Yes.
You can watch Everything Everywhere All at Once with a library card.
Yes.
Like you don't need cable.
Absolutely. And as we get into a scenario where truth is harder and harder to find, librarians are some of the best people at being able to get you accurate, true information on any subject you want. So this year I'm very committed to doing a lot of work to help the library continue to do the good work that they're already doing. That's something that there are already structures out there to help out with. Most libraries have a Friends of the Library nonprofit group that you can get involved with. Mm-hmm. I'm going to look into getting involved with at least one of my nearby libraries, Friends of the Library group. I would highly recommend that other folks do the same. I would also recommend, I am aware of this and am doing this in part because of the good work of an activist named Miriam Kaba, who has been very, very active in the prison abolition scene and now has been doing a lot of work around libraries. So I would highly recommend, particularly for justice, exactly the thing that you're like, I want more of this from the book. Good news. Miriam Kaba's got you covered. Do you want ideas about like what can you do today?
Right.
You, justice.
Me, now.
Yeah. to actually help with some of this stuff. She's got you covered. She's Great. Got tons of really good work there. There's a book of hers that I might suggest at some point for us to dive into that has to do with prison abolition. That I'm very interested in getting more involved with. And yeah. I think that might even mean I might start like posting stuff to social media sites.
Oh no. You were clean for so long.
I know. I'm still, I don't feel good about it, but we'll see.
I mean, like, if it would make you feel better.
Yes, go on.
I can volunteer my time. One of the things I can do is I will run a Mastodon server. I can do that. And then you can post. And then the only person that you're negatively influencing, like any, again, because it's that open protocol, anyone can subscribe to it. But also the only person who's like responsible for it is me, right? Like it's my fault that this is in the world. So I could do that for you. If you need it, let me know. Yeah. Blue Sky seems fine, but also because they have like the same open protocol connectivity. Yes. I see people using it from the whole thing is that you're supposed to be able to connect to it from a Mastodon instance eventually.
Yeah.
And they'll just do the curation part, which is the fucking hardest part of like running Mastodon servers. So, hey, we should do like an open source technology thing. There's a whole podcast about that.
Absolutely.
Will and Brad do a tech pod and like, but yeah, like the open source software community is such a foundational component, I think, of a lot of these tools outside of institutions. Mm-hmm. So like, hey, libraries, literally the library stuff would not work without like, I know they have contracts with Libby, which is through Overdrive, which they have actually offices local to us in the Cleveland area. And like, I could not imagine doing that, like, or not, I couldn't imagine reading all this shit and not having a library. Final thoughts for me is kind of that, right? You kind of got ahead of it, is I kind of want to know what to do next. And now you have a bunch of shit for me to do, which is great. The thing that my takeaway for this stuff is going to be a lot of very personal changes. Some of them may be very small, which is just how I approach situations, how I approach specific challenges around really any sort of topic, whether it's controversial, whether it influences anyone in any way, shape or form, especially as, you know, as a manager at work, there's stuff that I can do day to day to make the people who I am responsible for a little bit happier, potentially, or at least less fucked, right? Not even happier, just less fucked. And then there's things I can take into the long view and the long term, especially as we hit an election year. That's kind of what the easy way out for me is. Where can I put? I don't have a ton of extra money, but hey, but I have some disposable income, and instead of buying another fucking bottle of bourbon, I can volunteer my time or throw something, you know, one of the primary things you'll hear from people is money does really good.
Yeah.
When you want to see change happen, if you put money at something, they can do more with money than they can with a lot of other things. And it's never a bad idea. It's never a bad gift. No one's ever mad at money. So, it's things like, you know, my library system, and I don't mean the Cleveland one. I mean the Akron one, does a lot of really good work too. And like, I might not need to be engage with them daily, but if I just write them a check every so often about, hey, you're doing stuff, not just the library stuff that the taxes help pay for, but things outside of that and building these other programs, if I can put some money, you know, somewhere to assist with that, hey, I'd love to do that.
Yeah. And on that note, you know, there are a lot of, and sadly, Ohio is absolutely at the forefront of some of this stuff, but there are a lot of libraries and librarians that are dealing with an onslaught from, and the frustrating thing is that like it's a very small number of people who are actually behind this onslaught to get books banned, to like really push back against the open nature of the library. And it is incredibly helpful to those librarians to know that there are people out there that have their back, that it's not just a bunch of like, there are 11 people that filed almost all of the book banning requests in the nation.
And this book does a great job, and we just talked about it earlier, of like established common ground. And by removing access to those critical components, hey, Sarah J. Maas had an entire thing where everyone tried to get her banned from a library. Do I think those books are important?
Also, important note, the second book in that series.
Yeah.
Not the first one.
What's the first?
The second book.
Because the first one's fine. Somebody read the first one. It's there. I like the new. I like the new stuff better. I like the Crescent City stuff more. Anyway, like it's a shared context, right? And by removing that common ground, right? If that book is no longer available in a library or in a library system, all of our reading happens at libraries, Chris. For the most part, you know, like imagine not being, you know, not having access to things that we view as critical.
Oh,
or
man,
if we want to make fun of Sarah J. Maas and we can't fucking get the second book for free. You know, it, like I would be mad. Yeah. I would be disappointed. And you know, it's important to support these, the things that you like and the institutions that you have, and to provide space for them, especially whenever they're doing important and great work. And that's kind of been my takeaway, is I've been looking at doing more this year anyway.
Yep.
And reading this book, closing out 23 into 24, as everyone does the, well, this year I'm going to do this and this and this and this. I think it was really good for me to start the year with this conversation.
Yep.
Because I also left this book optimistic.
Yeah.
Because the first time through it, I was kind of like, well, this dough didn't work out, and like I'm looking for what to do next. And then the second time through it, I was like, you know, everything is okay with bread. And also, it's just about making change. It's about seeing and doing the necessary work to change the structure. And I'm excited.
I can't believe we're gonna end on a bread comment.
Yeah, we're gonna add. Like, yeah, we're gonna
really,
end on bread.
We're gonna drive it home
on bread. Chris, hey, thanks for your time, dude.
Yeah, this is great.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to us having more conversations about the work that we will be doing throughout the year on this front.
Mm-hmm.
I think
hold me accountable.
It's
also,
nice. Yeah, we've said it into microphones that look.
Someone will hear.
Yes, at least. Another person outside of us,
at least,
will know that we made these intentions, and we should let them know later on how we're hewing to the things we've suggested.
Yeah, for sure.
And you, listener, also go forth.
Yeah, do good.
Make the common ground a better common ground.
Excellent. That'll do it for us at Cultural Fugazi. We'll see you soon. Talking.
All right.
Where do you think you want to go for food after this?
Oh, good question.
Or we can order food, but unless you just want to go, the only thing I can think that you can eat is the tacos. We can go back to the taco bar.
No, we
can
do that.
And then if we want to get wild, we can stop for a drink beforehand or after.
Whoa! Oh man.
If we can get in, I'll look.
All right. Sounds good.